Hi, and welcome to this special episode of Forest for the Future. It's a special episode because most of the audio is from a webinar hosted by me in October 2025, focusing on how circular economy may help us ensure more resource resilience in a world which is geopolitically unstable. The conversation during the webinar was held between myself, Amloa Worm, in my capacity as the leader of the FSC Circularity Hub. The FSC Circularity Hub is an innovation initiative under FSC where we identify how we as FSC might help companies around the world adjust to circular business models and what our role is in the transition to a circular bioeconomy. I was joined in the webinar by Luisa Santiago, who is the Latin American lead of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. If you don't know the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, they're one of the world's leading voices in circular economy. We also had Nina Grieshammer, who is an independent consultant who supports NGOs in their work with forestry and circular economy. And she's the co-author of a very interesting and comprehensive report called Everything in Wood, which was published by WWF Germany and the University of Kassel. We also have Sebastian Mandiola, who is the Innovation and R&D Director of Arauco, which is one of the world's largest pulp producer and forest owners. And then we also had FSC's own Fabian Farkas, who is our Chief Commercial Officer. So before we dive deep into the conversation, why don't we start off with Luisa from Ellen MacArthur explaining us a little bit more about what circular economy is and why we're at such a crossroad.
We're talking about the two very big topics today. It's the economy and it's nature. And it's sad to see that these things haven't been working in sync for the past couple of centuries. And this is because our economy functions in a way that degrades nature due to its linear logic. The linear economy, which is predominantly what we have today and have had since the Industrial Revolution, is based on the logic that we take materials off the ground, we make products and goods, and we waste those materials in various forms. And this is the root cause of the triple planetary crisis that we're facing today. So take climate change, for example. While the main and predominant debate around climate change has very much been around the energy transition, the truth is that from our calculations, even if we succeed in transitioning to renewable energies and energy efficiency, we will only address about 55% of the reductions needed to meet the Paris Agreement. Because the other 45%, they come from the way we make and produce goods and food in a linear economy.
Let's halt, Luisa, for a second. 45% of our emissions are connected to the way that we produced and waste goods and foods? That's almost half of our emissions, which will not be fixed, even if we do manage to fix our energy systems. If that is the impact on carbon footprint, what is then the impact on biodiversity and ecosystems?
So it's also true for biodiversity loss, because linearity is in the root cause of more than 90% of biodiversity loss, because it is related to extractive polluting ways that we're using natural resources in the linear economy. And this needs to change. So a big part of that impact on biodiversity comes from the way we use land, and we change the use of land for agriculture and forestry activities, which are activities that account for a big part of the global GDP, half of the global GDP. How on earth can we still work in our economy in a way that is not in sync with nature if so much of our economic activity depends on it?
Let me just recap that. 90% of our biodiversity loss is connected to extraction, especially to forestry and agricultural sectors. And this accounts for half of our global GDP. How do we fix the forestry and agricultural sectors?
Paradoxically, these are the sectors that, depending on that thriving ecosystem, to really create the resilience in those activities. But those activities, they are also the ones that hold the biggest potential to revert that trend, not only fighting the climate change and biodiversity loss crisis, but also creating more resilient supply chains and increasing, as I said, economic resilience and global value chains. And this change will come from an approach based on the circular economy. The circular economy is an idea that makes a lot of sense as a new lens through which we can create long-term regenerative value in the economy. And it's based on three principles, all of them driven by design, which means we design the economy, we design products, services, systems with those three principles as the new lens to value for value creation. The first is about eliminating waste and pollution. The second is about circulating products and materials at their highest value in the economy. And the third is about regenerating nature.
I asked Louisa whether this is all possible. Can a sector or an industry shift these principles and still function as companies?
Back in 2019, we started a project with the fashion industries and textile industries to really redesign products in a way that clothes can be used more, made to be made again, made from safe, recyclable or renewable inputs. We engaged 100 companies from 25 countries around the world to apply the thinking of a circular design into an iconic product like jeans in the jeans redesign. And what we found and learned is that the industry players engaged in this journey, they were able and they could redesign 100% of their company's portfolio with circular economy principles, 100% of the portfolio. That's really important. It's possible, and not only possible, but also can ensure the longevity of the industry. But this requires concerted efforts in industry, of course, to apply voluntarily the circular economy thinking, but in policy to make the economics work and scale, and in redesigning systems so that the circular economy can be the norm. Currently, what we're seeing now, and we are starting to deep dive into this topic, is that there's a lack of policy integration in circular economy policies and in those policies that regulate bio-based materials. There's a missing opportunity here to capture the full potential of a circular economy that will effectively regenerate nature and create economic resilience and social benefits. And we hope that by normalizing this approach, in a transition to a circular economy that captures the full breadth of the types of materials, we can create an economy that not only reverts the crisis of climate change and biodiversity loss, but also builds the next stage of economic growth that will regenerate ecosystems that will benefit people and workers in the circular economy.
I think what Louisa said here is so important. This will not be easy, but we need to start having some of these conversations, even if they are difficult. And even if some of it may seem far out in the future. For me personally, there's no question that FSC must transition into being a driver for the circular economy. And I can also very easily see a future where we as FSC have created incentives for companies around the globe to use fibers at their highest possible economic and environmental value for products which are designed to last, which are designed for longevity. We will not be able to do this alone in FSC. We are looking for companies, we are looking for organizations who are already exploring parts of the things that we're also working with. We're looking for collaboration and we're looking for partnerships. So if you're out there listening to this, or if you're just a big dreamer like me, I'm always thinking big, then please do reach out to us. During the webinar, I was lucky enough to get to talk to some of those who we're already collaborating with and who are actually walking the talk. Each of them will be asked in a second to offer a sharp, short take on what it will take for us to really focus on fiber sourcing of bio-based materials in an era where we are in a geopolitical unstable environment and where we really need to build up resource resilience. So why don't we kick it off with Nina Grieshammer? I asked her to recap the most important points from the study Everything in Wood, which she coordinated with WWF Germany and the University of Kassel. They wanted to explore wood was the resource of the future or whether it could actually be the next crisis just waiting around the corner.
This study reviews the global consumption trends and the global wood availability. I want to give you some very brief key findings of the study, and I just started. Wood is a fascinating material. It's renewable and it's really widely applicable. We use it for houses, for furniture, for packaging, also for energy, for heating and cooking. And today it shows up in places where we never expected it, like in textiles and biochemicals and plastics. But the crucial question is, how much wood consumption is truly sustainable? Wood use is directly linked to the state of the forest, to their resilience, and also to the impact of climate change, which stress factors like drought, too much heat, or even more extreme forest fires or beetles. Let's first take a look at the global consumption. We call it in our study footprints. The biggest wood consuming sectors are paper and packaging, the construction sectors, furniture, and burning of wood for energy. Since the 1960s, global production of wood-based material, especially for construction and furniture, has increased almost 15-fold. Paper and packaging may double consumption by 2050. We are facing a dangerous gap on one side, sharply rising demand, and on the other side, decreasing availability.
Let me just pause Nina here as well. Doubled increased demand of forest-based products and wood? That really does sound like a dangerous supply-demand gap on the horizon, since we are already seeing industries fighting for materials that are coming out of forest. How do we handle this tension moving forward?
To explore ways if wood supply could be increased, we run several what-if scenarios in our study. And these future considerations, like increasing the area of plantation or more afforestation, showed that there's a limited potential to significantly expand global supply capacities. And these expansion capacities are far from being sufficient to meet global growing demand. And that brings me to the central finding of our study. Wood is renewable, but it is not unlimited available. Without reducing consumption, the remaining forest cannot be preserved, nor can the supply gap be closed. So, what can be done? The answer is very clear. We must use less virgin wood. We need to cut wasteful use in both production and consumption, and decide carefully where wood adds the most value for what purposes it should be used. Burning freshly harvested wood, for example, is one of the least options. The use and the consumption of wood must become just as sustainable as the management of forest, and that includes the FSC system.
So, Nina's calling for a change in the FSC system and in the way we use wood in general so that we use timber for the highest possible value. But how did we get there?
I would say we need to face certain facts if we want the bioeconomic transformation to succeed. Firstly, timber directly harvested from forest is a limited and precious resource. Wood is only one service forests deliver alongside many other vital ecosystem services. Extending the lifespan of wood is essential through cascading use and circular systems. Wood should be reused multiple times and only burned at the very end of its life cycle. Subsidies should help building cascading and circular wood systems and the necessary infrastructure. I give you an example. In Germany, where I'm based, 80% of the waste wood from households are directly burned. Even so, 90% or almost 90% could be reused and recycled. And the last point, we must start a dialogue about what we want to use wood for. We must set clear priorities. I want to close with a key message. The use of wood can be part of the transition, but only if we respect ecological and social boundaries, take equity into account, and stop overconsumption and waste. We have to close material cycles and create the right political framework. Only then wood will remain a sustainable material for the future rather than becoming yet another driver of ecological and climate crisis or even a cause of raw material shortages.
That message from Nina was quite clear. We need to start using wood more wisely and ensure that it's reused multiple times before it's ultimately burned. Because only then can we as societies ensure that we have resilient ecosystems. How does Fabian Farkas from FSC see the balancing act between wood as a resource and forestry ecosystems?
What I want to pick up on is, based on what Luisa said, talking about forestry and agriculture as key drivers for risks to the system, but also for resilience. And I want to pick up on the forestry part, of course, coming from the Forest Stewardship Council, and talk a bit about forests as the backbone of ecosystem and economic resilience, and how circular economy and our own role comes in there. Resilience is no longer a choice, but a necessity. Strategies around circular economy are essential to decouple the economic growth from resource consumption and environmental degradation. And it's also important to strengthen economic resilience by reducing dependence on volatile global markets and by improving supply chain stability. The good news, as we've heard already today, is that policy momentum is growing. The EU is advancing the Circular Economy Act. Brazil has launched a national plan. Other global frameworks are emerging. And at the same time, we also see that in the business world, attention is shifting from like ESG strategies in general to risk mitigation and supply chain resilience in particular. So these developments signal a shift toward a new economic model, one that prioritizes regeneration, efficiency, and resilience. What's our role in that? At FSC, we are determined to think ahead. We created the Circularity Hub 2 years ago already, or more than 2 years ago, as a future-focused innovation platform to work on some of tomorrow's solutions already today. The hub acts as a dedicated accelerator that turns circular ambitions into action. It scales up existing solutions on the one hand within FSC, but also explores new approaches beyond traditional certification, working with partners across industries. Crucially, we're doing this now. This is important so as that when new laws and market demand for circular practices comes in, FSC has solutions ready. But, and that's the kind of call that I'll close with, for that, we need everyone to ensure that forest resilience and circularity ensure ecological stability and economic survival. So FSC invites everyone to act, but not just by sourcing FSC-certified materials and expanding certification across supply chains, but also by co-creating circular solutions. After all, the choices that we make today will shape the forests, economies, and societies of tomorrow. So we want to choose resilience, and we want to choose circularity.
Fabian, and us at FSC are calling for action and transition today of supply chains, not only to FSC-certified supply base, but also to circular business models so that we can reduce pressure on forests. But with Fabian, Nina, and Luisa as the first three speakers of the day, we've heard from people who are fortunate enough to be in roles in this world where we think and we do big systems. That is why I'm also very happy that we got Sebastian on a panel as well. He's the Innovation and R&D Director of Arauco, so he represents a company who's actually implementing all of these big ideas and is in the middle of the shift. So let's hear from him.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. At Arauco, we think that besides all of the efforts that we're doing of implementing circularity, we also need to think about how do we build resilience for the forest. Because if we don't have the forest, at the end of the day, we will have nothing to do the circular economy with. We think of resilience not only of a forest, but also all of the ecosystems that surrounds it. The resilience is the capacity of those ecosystems to restore itself after disturbances and to adapt to the new conditions that the world is creating today. Those ecological functions as carbon capture, erosion control, conserving biodiversity, which is the most important, are critical and are the key aspect that today these ecosystems are losing because of climate change, because of all of the environmental crisis that we're living. And that's why, for example, in our company, we have decided to move towards the measurement of natural capital as a part very important and very crucial to strengthening the resilience of our forests and the areas that we operate. During last year, we finished doing that, and that allows us in a very simple way, in a very transparent way, to communicate the benefits and the impacts of our operations in the ecosystems that we operate. We did that in over 1 million hectares in Chile. We were able to evaluate not only wood, but also carbon capture, biodiversity, water, recreation, and management of non-wood products. And this information has been crucial for us to make decisions of how to manage a sustainable forest. The main strategies that we're using for building resilience is the diversification of the species that we're using in the different areas that we're working, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile. We're working very hard in the ecological restoration. Arauco has restored already more than 17,000 hectares with native forests in Chile, Brazil, and Argentina. And we have a goal to achieve more than 25,000 hectares in those three countries in the next years. We are going to keep monitoring and researching from the ecosystems that we're in order to make sure that we're making the right decisions. We have incorporated technologies like hyperspectral sensors, satellite monitoring, and that allows us to obtain a lot of high-resolution data on biodiversity, on forest health, on water stress. We're going to keep doing that. I think that the future of availability of virgin fibers that will sustain a circular economy depends on our ability to build stronger and sustainable ecosystems. Resilience not only protects the ecosystem, but also ensures that our future generations can benefit from the resources that the forest brings. So it's important to work on both. And it's our responsibility to preserve these natural treasures, ensuring that they continue to be a source of life and well-being for the planet. We strongly believe that there's no resilience without science, nor sustainability without collaboration. Those are two things that for us are very important. And that we integrate knowledge, innovation, commitment to people and nature to make sure that forests continue to be a source of life.
So for Arauco, a large part of building resilience as a company also means building resilient ecosystems by bringing in more data and knowledge as a backbone of making informed decisions. I asked Sebastian to reflect a bit upon, from a business perspective, whether all of these recent developments in both climate change and geopolitical space has made circular economy more relevant for Arauco. For example, does the growing volatility actually impact the work that he does, and does it spark any new conversations inside the company about circular economy?
It definitely does. And I think that here's where you see the companies that think long-term and the companies that think short-term. When you think about the geopolitical volatility, there are companies that are cutting costs and survival mode is the only thing that they can do or they want to do. And they're driving away from circular economy, from reuse, from recycling, from those efforts. Companies like ours, that we think long-term, we don't drive away. We see this as an opportunity. We see it as an opportunity to invest, to investigate, to make more research, to start product development that allows us to be part of what is going to be the future in that sense.
The question then is whether Ellen MacArthur Foundation and Luisa is also seeing the same kind of pickup in interest too as an organization who works a lot with companies.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the 15 years that we've been out there in the market, we've seen companies doing a lot to try and voluntarily put action in the market, new products, new services, new business models. When it comes to bio-based materials, or even if we cut to, down to forest materials, not so much. We are seeing action happening around fast-moving consumer goods that want to move away from flexible, single-use, flexible packaging, which is an opportunity for forest products, of course. It's not just about substitution. I think there is more about the circulation of whatever materials from forest materials or from others. And I think that frontiers is yet to be crossed. And I hope that the work, the paper that we're going to be publishing very soon is the first kind of stepping stone for us to have more and more companies around that. In no way saying that, you know, the FSC network hasn't been doing, you know, its job. It's just that I think that momentum is still to be captured, I think.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing, when you're saying that, yes, there's more interest from companies, are you seeing also more seriousness behind and less exploration and faster we want to get somewhere?
Yes, I think, you know, with that much policy being developed, the rules are clearly changing. So definitely more seriousness. So that, what I think is interesting in the circular economy space is that we always want to see the business case behind it. So it's more agnostic to the morale of people. It's more about the business case happen, which many times is about the quick wins that the companies see themselves, but also many times is about the policy environment that will enable more scaled action and value to be, you know, the normal rather than the exception. But definitely with moving policy together with business action, the sweet spot for, I think, the actual implementation of circular economy practices.
The interesting thing, Luisa, about what you say about the business case is that that's driven in part by something that we see coming out of political realities changing, where a lot of ESG strategies and sustainability initiatives are suddenly changing track. What they are rather asking for now is, how do you sell the same activities under a different narrative that's focused on risk mitigation, on supply chain resilience, and that includes, of course, circularity and other areas of work, but is very much focused on the what does it bring as a return, right? And so in that sense, it doesn't become circularity is the big topic or sustainability is the big topic, but what makes the most business sense and what's the business case for resilience? And then naturally and automatically, circularity does come up more and more frequently. And that means that also in FSC, we of course see more interest in like aspects of the circularity hub, in aspects of sustainable forest management in general, and interest of investors in terms of how can we adjust to these changing narratives and changing realities.
I think that is really important. Both Fabian and Luisa point out here that it's both the political environment and just business sense that is driving the uptake in circular economy. How does the researcher Nina see it? What specific kinds of new research or new data points could help us accelerate the transition needed?
For me, it's the other way around. I think the situation is absurd because we have subsidies for burning, for example, for big mills, but we do not have subsidies or infrastructure for going to, versus recycling and cascading use. So for me, it's not the science or some figures who are blocking the change or the transition. It's more put the political will or the willingness and the understanding that the use of the wood is overexploiting forests. So we have to work on the subsidies, for example.
The question then is, if we don't have the right political settings and subsidies in place right now, if we have all the knowledge that is needed, how can we make the transition happen faster? How can we motivate it? This is something that the Ellen MacArthur Foundation has worked with a lot. Let's hear Luisa's take on this and then just let the conversation unfold a bit for a while after there.
Picking up the first part of the question about how to make this, socialize this and make this compelling, for me, case studies, they are the best way to communicate. Because, you know, if you get a company to invest, to change, to do something differently, what can be more powerful, particularly if they're able to showcase the metrics that they used or the results in terms of both, you know, the nature results, let's call it like that, as well as the economic results. I think nothing can be more powerful than that. And that's for business audience, but also for policymakers. I mean, policymakers, they're not against the industry in general. They want to see their industries thrive. And we see that very often. They're protective about their industries. They want to see the jobs that they can generate. You know, the audiences, particularly in the global south, will be very, very compelled by those things as well.
So for you, for example, Sebastian, what is the biggest barrier for you in a transition to a circular economy?
Incentives is what drives behavior at the end of the day. And incentives can be created by governments. It can be created by a market, can be created by different statements of the society. We are not aligning the incentives in the correct way. Each one of us has a way of thinking of how we're going to get there. We all want to get to the same place, but we have different paths of how we want to get there. And we need to sit down together and agree on a way that we're going to go through the path together. And it might be not perfect for me, not be perfect for the other, but be a path that we can all go, and we can do it fast. Because if we keep doing it, each one of us in its own way, it's going to take forever.
But sitting down, all of us together, having a conversation and agreeing also does not sound super fast for me. Nina, if I transition to you.
Totally.
from your perspective, what is the biggest barrier right now? Is that lack of incentives too?
Lack of incentives, yes, but it's also, but I'm coming back to the mindset. We have to recognize and to agree that timber is limited. It's renewable, it's regrowing, but it's limited. And I think we are lying a little bit to ourselves and saying, yes, we replacing plastic, replacing concrete, we replacing oil through timber and wood, and then everything is fine and everything is sustainable. But this is a big lie. I think another point is really to understand that circularity in its best way is a closed loop. It couldn't be fed all the time with fresh fiber. It has to be fed with waste wood, reclaimed wood, but we don't have to think circularity in an open loop where we feed in all the time fresh fresh fibers.
So when you work with companies, when you work with NGOs, what is your best piece of advice that you give them when you want to flip that mindset of, well, it's renewable fiber, we can always...
Really to understand there are limitations. If we don't accept the limitations we have, we are running into deforestation, we're running into more climate crisis, and we are running into a crisis of the resource of timber.
What about you, Luisa? If you're working directly with companies in one of your pilots and you stumble upon these barriers, which are the ones we also saw people list as the biggest barriers, the cultural mindsets, the difficulty of shifting supply chains, what is then your best piece of advice to addressing these barriers?
I mean, I really like what Sebastian said about putting everyone on the same table. Maybe if we can be very focused on getting a retail system, get a, you know, maybe the fashion industry, get value chain actors together, try to, yes, pilot, but also very rapidly scale. So I think, you know, putting the value chain actors together, for me, it sounds like a very powerful tool. And of course, aligning on that basic common principle of we need to create supply resilience, we need to ensure the longevity of the sources that we are using. Yes, also bringing in policy so that, you know, the rules of the game change, you know, to reflect the new potentials and the new reality. But yeah, maybe finding that entry point and putting the actors together would be my first bet for this challenge. Mm-hmm.
Is that realistic in global supply chain? Can we actually get to a point where we can actually trace back and have a proper circular economy and not just replace our own in Europe resource overconsumption in other areas of the world?
I tend to believe it is realistic. We didn't talk much about trade here. Trade is a very element of this story, right? I did touch upon the fact that, you know, most of the bio-based materials, they are produced in the global south. But in our research, our current research, we're also seeing that a lot of the standards, a lot of the mechanisms on the trade system are not aligned to, one, favor or give open more markets for products produced in a certain way that aligns with the circular economy principles. Standards that are not reflecting the reality of the productions and weather of areas of the world that have, for example, more mild weathers or different climate. So they're very much built around one type of weather, like the global, you know, the more temperate climate. So there's so many things that need to be done on global value chains. But again, I believe in the power of putting those value chain actors together and pilot that and really prototype something that can be different, and in parallel needing to run with national legislations and with trade systems to align behind that vision of a circular economy. It's not simple, it's big, but I tend to see, yes, I think it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Fabian, what role could you see FSC play in such a shift in global supply chains and traceability?
I mean, FSC has been built as a platform. And that's kind of what we're hearing now as well, right? It's bringing together different voices, bringing together different viewpoints for dialogue and engagement. FSC can inject itself into the dialogue and is injecting itself into that dialogue and bring together people such as today. The important thing that FSC, I think, brings to the table is that it, like this holistic view of looking at the economic, the environmental, and the social aspects and trying to find solutions that work for everyone. That's something that's, you know, difficult to find in today's world. And especially when, Sebastian, what you mentioned earlier, right, when we all go back a little bit unhappy, but at the same time still moving forward, that is something that becomes more and more difficult to do nowadays in a take it or leave it mentality that comes through more and more. And that's where, like, we already have a platform that's built on 30 years of history, integrity, and trust. And it can also be leveraged for various forward-looking topics as well. So in that sense, injecting FSC into the discussion and the positioning around circularity is just a natural continuation of what we're anyways setting out to do.
So if we then ask Nina, Luisa, and Sebastian, what should FSC be doing? If we had to do one thing differently from our current system, if you can choose one thing that we should truly accelerate for us to really have impact on solving some of the barriers for a transition to a circular economy, what should that be? Sebastian, I'm going to start with you because it's been a while since I let you in.
I'm going to take Fabian's words because I think that at the end of the day, and in yours as well, it's obvious that it's very difficult to get a group of people with every very different kind of way of thinking to agree. And there has to be a leader. There has to be a leader that sets the strategy and says, this is where we're going. And we're going to make as much as possible to move in this direction. And in that conversation, nobody's going to walk away 100% happy. I think FSC needs to lead the way in that, understand that it's impossible to have all of the parties happy at the same time. Because, and I have seen this in many organizations, that there's a pitfall of change. And there's actually cartoons and things like that. Everybody wants change. But when you ask who wants to change, nobody wants to. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. So in my opinion, what should FSC do? It's lead the way. Lead the way with conviction, lead the way with enthusiasm, but lead the way knowingly that there are people that it's not going to be entirely happy, and it's part of what it has to be.
Lead the way. Nina, what would you have us do if there's one thing that we should focus on?
Be a platform and go further with the dialogue on for what wood should be used. Like you mentioned in your early words, Lua, for what should FSC products be used? For energy, for building, and maybe also feed it into the debate or the revision of the PNCs, which already had started. We have to take into account also when we talk about or debate about forest management standards, we have to think about planetary boundaries. This has also to be taken into the account. So prioritization of wood for what FSC products should be used. Take it as a baseline for all the thinking within the FSC system that we are working with a limited resource and that timber is only one of the many ecosystem services forests deliver.
Louisa, if you had one thing that we should do, what would that be?
How can you create value of multiple uses to maybe the landowner or the country that owns that land or the company that owns that source? So I think that ongoing capitalization of the value of the forest and all its values, both in ecosystem services, of course, we know that, but what about the material? I think there are other ways of monetizing that if we think of circularity and circulation in multiple uses, so that, you know, it makes it a compelling economic case for forest producers to produce in a certain way, for off-takers to think of certain business models. So there's something in that space that when you said that, there was a bit of a spark here in my mind. And I'd love to keep discussing that with you.
Fabian, what's your takeaway from these inputs of where we should be focusing our energy?
I mean, I hear all this loud and clear, and it's various places within FSC where these kind of discussions and decisions need to be reflected. And I mean, Nina, you mentioned our principles and criteria revision, but there is also like our chain of custody revision. There is the review of a global strategy for the next strategy cycle, as the current one is ending next year. So there is all these different places where the General Assembly, of course, later in the year, which are all spaces where the positioning of FSC and the contribution of FSC can and has to be negotiated on circularity and in general on guaranteeing that there is like sustainable forests for all forever, as we like to say, which includes like a long time into the future. And in the meantime, of course, it's important to like create the space, the hub for dialogue, for innovation, and like really be that platform, which we are also trying to do through the Circularity Hub. So all these points are not new, all these points are moving us in a certain direction, and we just need to get going and continue to get going in the direction of more resilient supply chains that cover economic, environmental, and social perspectives equally.
That concludes my conversation with our panelists. I would like to thank Luisa, Nina, Sebastian, and Fabian for giving me all of their perspectives on circular economy and how we can get towards a place where it's a reality. There is no doubt that we will need to bring as many voices as we can to the table. And yes, not everyone will agree, and we will all walk away not getting everything we wanted. But for me, that's the beauty of FSC and exactly what our role in this world is, to find the compromises on the difficult topics so that we can all move in a better direction than before. And we will have to do research. We will have to do pilots. We will have to engage with politicians, and we will have to get partners from all around the world to pull this off. But I'm also quite sure that we will get there. And I am proud to get to lead that work in FSC as the leader of the FSC Circularity Hub in my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. That was it for today. Remember that you are always welcome to send me ideas for new topics to cover or comments on podcast@fsc.org. My name is Laura Wurm, and this was Forest for the Future.